You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
We've all heard that industries like logging, mining, and oil drilling often pose threats to indigenous people around the world. But what about environmental conservation? Creating a nature preserve can also lead to the removal of people from their homelands. Journalist Mark Dowie joins me now on today's Underreported. He has written an article called Conservation Refugees for Orion magazine. Mr. Dowie is the recipient of 18 journalism awards, including 4 national magazine awards. I'm very pleased to welcome him to my show today. Hello.
Good morning, Leonard.
Good morning where you are. That's what, Los Angeles?
No, I'm about 50 miles north of San Francisco, near Point Reyes Station.
How would you define the term conservation refugees, and how are they different from ecological refugees?
Well, ecological or environmental refugees are people who voluntarily leave their homelands because they become unlivable for one reason or another, usually as a consequence of flooding, drought, disease vectors, and things that are caused by the shifting weather patterns and climate patterns of the world. There's a lot of people being driven out of the tropical areas by this very phenomenon. They leave voluntarily. Conservation refugees leave their land involuntarily at the behest of conservationists who are sort of using the wilderness model of conservation to protect biological diversity.
And is this happening all over the world?
Every continent but Antarctica.
And what about the United States? We don't see any Blackfeet or Nez Perce in Yellowstone National Park.
Well, we started it. I mean, that this is where it started. It started with Yosemite, spilled over to Yellowstone and about a dozen other American parks, which were once the hunting grounds and homelands of Native American people.
Well, how does that happen? Because there are some national parks and reserves where American Indians are allowed to live. Monument Valley, for example.
Yeah.
Canyon de Chelly.
Yes. And Death Valley here in California. But these are resettlements. They're letting people come back in. They're giving them some management responsibilities. They're allowing them to practice their life ways, which often includes hunting and certainly includes gathering pine nuts and things. Yeah, there is some improvement definitely here and some resettlement of national parks by Native people. And that's happening elsewhere in the world as well. If you look far enough ahead on this story, I can see a happy ending because conservationists are beginning to realize that what they call fortress conservation or exclusionary conservation is a big mistake. It's not only a moral and cultural mistake in terms of how it affects the people. It's also an ecological mistake.
But John Muir, who is an environmental hero to most people, is at the source of this, isn't he? He thought that wilderness should be cleared of all inhabitants.
You know, I'm writing about that right now, and it's a little uncertain exactly what John Muir was doing. It turns out he knew or had to know that Yosemite had been occupied for thousands of years by 3 separate tribes of Indians, and but he when he lobbied for the park to Roosevelt, Teddy Roosevelt, he said, "This is virgin wilderness. No one has ever lived here," and that's the sort of Euro-romantic view, the sort of Edenic view of wilderness that motivated a lot of the national parks and still does around the world. The creation of protected areas is this sort of view that wilderness is a place where humans don't exist.
Muir
started that myth.
Humans, in fact, in this myth are not part of nature. They're inherently enemies of nature. But isn't much of this potential parkland considered invaluable because of the people who've lived there for generations, because they've been good stewards?
Exactly. I mean, if you look at the social history of Yosemite Valley, which is the heart of Yosemite National Park, it's the one that all the postcards come from, and it was occupied for on and off for thousands of years by at least 3 different tribes of Indians, the Miwoks, the Awanishi, and the Paiutes. There may have been more, but they were certainly there for a long time. They burned the valley out. periodically. They cultivated it. They pruned the trees. They planted things there. It was their garden. It was their kitchen. They migrated in and out in the winters, and they brought stock in. It was not a wilderness as John Muir would have had us believe it was. It was a homeland to Native people for thousands of years.
We're talking with journalist Mark Dowie about conservation refugees on today's Underreported. Are conservation refugees always forcibly removed from their lands?
No, not always. They have a term that they use called soft eviction. A soft eviction is when they're allowed to stay, but their life ways are so limited that they basically can't survive any longer. In other words, their hunting and gathering are restricted, their fishing is restricted, and they're pretty much handed a new social contract in return for being allowed to stay there. But in many, many cases, the contract is a starvation contract.
But this also grows out of the idea that it's a good thing to protect land by creating nature reserves and parks. Shouldn't we be glad that there's a drive to protect more lands?
Absolutely. And there is. It's very impressive the amount of land that has come under protection in the last 30 or 40 years. In 1962, the year I graduated from college, there were 1,000 protected areas on the planet-wide. There are now 108,000 and climbing. New protected areas are created every day, every week. That's an impressive accomplishment when you consider it on the surface. But when you consider the number of people who have been displaced and whose cultures have been ruined in the process, it becomes less impressive. And I'm heartened by the fact that northern conservationists, people who are working for Conservation International and the Nature Conservancy and the World Wildlife Fund and the Wildlife Conservation Society, they are now starting to see that they have to create a new conservation paradigm that includes people in the process, the local people and the indigenous people who have been living there for thousands of years. I mean, they realize now that the land that they're seeking to protect by creating these protected areas have high biological diversity because the people who've been living there for thousands of years have been living sustainably.
But isn't this move to protect lands the result of human encroachment on animal habitats, an attempt to create a space for elephants, for example, or the big cats that set to disappear otherwise by people claiming more and more of the land for farms?
That is true. And I'm not talking about those people. I'm not talking.
So we have people and people here?
Yeah, definitely. I'm not talking about colonists and settlers who follow the roads that are being built into the forest for logging and set up little villages along the side of the road and start logging themselves and creating farms in the tropics. No, I'm not talking about those people. I think those people should be evicted. I'm talking about the people who have been living there sustainably outside the money economy for thousands of years. They're good stewards of the land, or we wouldn't be interested in the land, and I think we should let them stay there and remain good stewards.
Let's talk about one of the groups that you look at, the Batwa tribe in Uganda.
Yeah.
What happened to them?
They lived in three forests in Uganda, and one by one, beginning in the 1930s, these forests were turned into national parks. But at first, they were just what they call paper parks. They just existed on paper. There was no enforcement. There was no research being done. And the Batwa pygmies stayed in those parks until the 1980s. So for 50 years, they were living in national parks. In a way, and they weren't disturbing the parks or the ecology of the park in any way at all. Then Diane Fossey, who was the gorilla studier, and you know, Gorillas in the Mist, the famous movie starring Sigourney Weaver, was about her. She believed, or came to believe, or was led to believe incorrectly, that the Batwa were killing and eating the great apes, the mountain gorillas. They, in fact, do not kill anything that they believe has a human face or a human connection. They feel a strong kinship to the apes, and they were never killing them. But the rumor spread around that they were, and when those parks were created, the Batwa were moved out of the parks into resettlement communities around the parks.
And what's happened to them since they left their ancestral land?
They have become the indentured servants of the dominant Bantu people, who are more dominant. They're more recent, and they're more urbane people. And the Batwa pygmies work as their indentured servants on their farms, living in shanties and hovels on the perimeter of the parks. And they're kept out of the parks, except for occasionally they can get a permit to go in and harvest some honey. Occasionally they get a permit to go in and visit the grave sites of their ancestors, but they're not allowed to hunt or gather in their old hunting grounds.
Don't some of these things change with changes in governments? The Central Kalahari Game Reserve was created by Botswana in the 1960s to protect and preserve the San culture. And then in 2002, there was a decision to resettle the San outside of the reserve.
And it's a disaster. If you visit any of the resettlement camps, the most popular one, or most the largest one, is one called Nukade. And Nukade has taken people who were living in hundreds of thousands of hectares, hundreds of thousands of acres, and jammed them into something the size of a Texas trailer court. They've built a little bit of infrastructure. The most interesting part of the infrastructure in the community is the bar, which is a very active bar. So they've driven these people into these little settlement camps that look rather like any really low-end refugee camp in the world, and they're drinking, they're prostituting, they're in the bottom of the money economy. There are a few sand bushmen that are still living out in the wild, but they're being rounded up and brought into these camps.
Is this the way it has to be? In the 19th century, the Cherokee were removed from their lands in the Southwest and relocated to Oklahoma, and they seem to have managed to retain a strong cultural identity nonetheless.
They are amazing. It's true. And I would say that they would be the indigenous exception to that rule. Certainly the Batwa are having a terrible time maintaining their culture, their traditions, their songs, the world for them is so different now than it was in the forest that they really, really are having a terrible time trying to survive. And there are a lot of people over there helping them, and a lot of American missionaries there that are trying to help them adjust to this new world. And for a few of the young ones, it's working, but it's not working because they're maintaining their own culture. It's working because they're assimilating into Bantu and other African cultures.
My guest is Mark Dowie. He's written an article called Conservation Refugees for Orion magazine. And we are discussing those refugees on today's Underreported. We will continue our conversation right after this. And we're back with the award-winning journalist Mark Dowie, who has written an article for Orion magazine called Conservation Refugees. We're talking about it for today's Underreported segment. Why are ancestral lands so important to cultural identity? Most Americans don't have a long connection to where they live, and yet they have a lot of patriotic fervor.
I'm from Wyoming, and there were people in my community there that had settled four or five generations before I arrived, and they felt a pretty strong kinship to their land, I think, because they buried their people on the land. They regarded it as ancestral land. So you could go out behind a ranch house and see the gravestones of people four or five generations before. I think when you start to do that, you start to get a feeling of ancestry attached to your land. So I think that is happening in America now. But remember, we're a nation of immigrants. We came from ancient societies, mostly in Europe, but other parts of the world. And a lot of our kinship is still attached to those societies rather than to anything that has happened here. But as I say, there, I think you're starting to find now in Americans whose ancestors came here four or five generations ago a sense of ancestry here.
What's happening in Thailand? Why has the Thai government suddenly decided to create a lot of national parks?
Because they were given a lot of money to do so. They were given money by the World Bank and the Global Environmental Facility, which is a branch or spin-off of the World Bank, to take what were a bunch of paper parks and turn them into real national parks and to develop a bunch of new national parks. I think the fastest growing national park nation in the world is Thailand. I'm sure that's true. I have the numbers somewhere in my article, but there were, 20 years ago there were a handful of paper parks, and now there's something like 124 land parks and a couple of dozen marine parks. It's they've gone park crazy.
But doesn't this also reflect a real need for parks?
I would say there's a need in that part of the world, as there's a need anywhere, to protect the biological diversity of their land. I would posit that the biological diversity of the hills of Thailand were doing just fine, because hill tribes that the hill tribe people in, that live in that part of the world are good stewards.
Do the outsiders, the funders, like the World Bank or like the World Wildlife Fund, the Nature Conservancy, have any say in what happens to the people who are living on a nature reserve that they are funding?
Good question. I think when the World Bank and the GEF first got into this business, they didn't believe they needed to have any say. They were just funding the development of conservation, the development of protected areas. The World Bank particularly has come to realize that displacing people and evicting people is bad policy. They realized at first with the whole business of just economic development, building big dams and other projects like that that was displacing people and impoverishing them in the process, or taking poor people and making them even poorer. They've come to realize that the same applies with the development of conservation areas and protected areas. So they're starting to get pretty strict about how displacement is carried out when it's deemed necessary, how people are compensated. The World Bank now insists that people be moved to better land and be compensated for any loss of infrastructure. So that part of the situation is improving. But what is still very, very difficult to contain is the destruction of culture when you move people off ancestral land.
And the people, go ahead.
When you're moving them into the money economy.
And in those areas, is this seen as Western paternalism and racism? Do they see the World Wildlife Fund, the Nature Conservancy, as big conservation in much the way some other people talk about big pharma?
Yes. There is definitely an attitude amongst indigenous people worldwide about conservation. They believe, as they've always believed, that they were the first conservationists, and that they are, by and large, there's some exceptions, but by and large, they're the best conservationists. And so they're saying to big conservation, why are you doing this to us? You can learn more from us than we can learn from you about conservation. Why don't you leave us here, bring your scientists in, do your research, help us sophisticate our ecological understanding, and we'll teach you our traditional knowledge, and together we will protect a lot more land than if you kick us off.
There are some countries that are seriously troubled because of political unrest. Chad is one of them, a spillover from what's happening across the border in Sudan and all the refugees from Darfur. And you found that conservation refugees are a big problem there as well.
Yeah, Chad, Cameroon, Central Africa, Eastern Africa, that's where I'm spending most of my effort right now, because that's where historically it's been the worst. There and in India, it's been the worst. And so I think that it's there that the model, the exclusionary model, needs to be challenged the hardest. because there it's been the most devastating. There are more conservation refugees on the African continent than anywhere any other continent.
But there are also there are an awful lot of political refugees as well. Do they overlap?
Well, yes and no. I mean, I assume they do. I just really don't know the answer to that. But the interesting answer to that question is that conservation refugees aren't counted because they're rarely moved across national boundaries. They don't count as refugees, so they don't get refugee status from the UN and the other refugee agencies. They're in what are called internally displaced people. They call themselves conservation refugees because they are moved across what they have always considered to be national boundaries, that being the boundary of their area, their homeland. So they do call themselves conservation refugees. They call themselves refugees. And I do, too. I sympathize with that designation. And I'm very concerned about political refugees. I'm concerned about refugees of all sorts. But I'm focused right now on this particular category of refugee because it is a separate problem and it is a distinct problem, and it can be stopped. And I think if it is stopped, it will be to the benefit of the world's biota. The entire biological diversity of the world will improve.
Have human rights groups become involved in this?
Yes. Yes, and the cultural survival groups, Survival International, Cultural Survival, and Ecoterra, and places and organizations like that, and human rights, yes, absolutely, as they should.
My guest is Mark Dowie, who has written an article called Conservation Refugees for Orion Magazine. He's talking to us today on our underreported segment. This is WNYC 93.9 AM 820. We're online at WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. So you mentioned that you're working to change things. Are you going to these places?
Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely.
What would you like to see happen? Do land conservation and cultural conservation have to be at odds?
What I'm trying to encourage, Leonard, is the initiation, the local initiation of conservation and protected areas. So I'm trying to encourage, and this is happening, and I'm trying to encourage it by reporting it. It's indigenous people creating their own protected area, mapping their homeland, and then going to the state government in which they're encompassed and saying, here's our land. Here's the map we've drawn around it. This has been our traditional hunting ground, and we've lived inside this area. We'd like you to officially create this, designate this a protected area, and we'll take this little part of it right here and in the center or off on one side of it, and we'll turn it into a national park, which we will manage, and we will collect the gate fees, and we will do the licensing of ecotourism enterprises. And we will do the licensing of bioprospectors and research scientists to come in. In other words, we will control and manage the park. To me, that's the future model, because then the indigenous people who know the area better than anybody ever will get to stay there, live their lives as they have always lived their lives. And if you're going to move people into the money economy, that's the way to do it. Let them have their own enterprises, collect their own fees, and buy what they want with the money they raise. Rather than put them on food aid, which so often happens and is happening right now in Ethiopia. A tribe is being driven out of a national park right now that have lived in that area for thousands of years, and they're going directly into food aid.
Isn't something like what you're proposing being done in Australia?
Yes, it started in Australia, really. The whole idea of indigenous protected areas. The Aboriginals in Australia went to the government, first of all demanded tenure, then they demanded land rights, then they demanded the deed on the land that they'd lived in all these years. And the government, this was during a time when the Australian government was noticeably more progressive than it is now, they went along with it, and they gave them, and then they said, now we want to create a national park here, and we want to manage it. So that was, they were called IPAs, Indigenous Protected Areas. You're right. It was that it was invented by the Aboriginal people of Australia with the cooperation of the government, and it's working very, very well.
But a recent study indicates that the life expectancy of Aboriginals is 18 years shorter than other Australians, and John Howard, the Australian Prime Minister, has called for a new paternalism. So we have the end of paternalism on the one hand and then a new paternalism on the other.
It's true that, you know, this is not solving all the problems of Aboriginal people overnight. To me, it's solving conservation problems more than social problems. But it is in those cases, the places that I've seen, the community conservation areas and indigenous protected areas, it is improving the social situation as well.
But if people stay in these IPAs, won't they be changing their traditions anyway, working as park rangers, probably driving around in jeeps and the like? In the end, does it just become another version of changing people?
Yes. And that's a lamentable consequence of all forms of assimilation, is that cultures get wrecked and cultures get changed. But I think it's better to have them working for themselves than working for a National Park Service. And I mean, you look at the Native people that work for the National Park Services here. They're dressing up in uniforms that have nothing to do with their culture. They're carrying guns, and they're patrolling against people in their own culture. That doesn't happen because the people who live there are not kicked out and they're not returning to the protected area as poachers and squatters. They still live there. So there is a much higher degree of cultural preservation involved with doing it this way than having the national government create a park and then hiring the indigenous people and putting them in national park uniforms to patrol the park.
Mark Dowie's piece, Conservation Refugees, was published by Orion Magazine. Thank you so much for participating in Underreported on our show today.
You're welcome. It's been my pleasure.